I'm going to talk about, this is really going to be a sort of a socio-political sermon this morning, but it really is very closely related, as you'll see, to things that I was talking about yesterday, things that I'll be talking about with you privately in next week's conference. It's based on an article that I wrote in collaboration with Aaron Bookbinder and Turab Lukman at Los Alamos. And it was Turab who introduced me to some of the data got me all excited about what was going on there. And a lot of what I'm going to say is based on stuff that Bookbinder and I did a few years ago about fundamentals of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. Now, for those of you who've never heard of a dislocation, I have to show one slide that says, well, if you have a crystal, most of us here aren't interested in crystalline plasticity, but if you have a crystal and it can have an extra plane of atoms. This is right in there. I'm going to have to use an analog pointer again. Don't we have an analog pointer? Pull.
Your finger will
work. I'll get you one. The stick. Oh, of course, it's buried in the corner there. All right. Otherwise, I wouldn't have anything to aim at Google. you have these extra planes of atoms you're shearing in this direction. And the way this sort of material deforms is if this dislocation moves, I guess, in that direction, and this one moves. In any case, however, the thing ends up with a kink on this side, an inward-looking kink on that side. And that's the lowest energy way of creating a deformation in a crystal. And that's all you're going to need to know, that deformations form lines. Actually, the picture that I showed here, that's a numerical simulation using dislocation dynamics. And these are lines of dislocations, and you see at subsequent times, and this one bulges out and fills the whole thing and creates a certain amount of plastic deformation by moving in that way. Now, I want to start by quoting some fairly recent statements by people who were the big people in the field. Here's Alan Cottrell, who wrote 50 years earlier than this one of the great monographs on dislocation theory, and he says that strain hardening, which he means dislocation-mediated plasticity, rather than turbulence, and he didn't really understand anything about glasses, other words he would have said here, is the most difficult remaining problem in classical physics. Neither of the two main strategies of theoretical physics work. The many-body single approach doesn't work, and the statistical mechanics won't work, he says. And that's because what happens is that the behavior of the whole system is governed by that of the weakest links and is thermodynamically irreversible. That raises my eyebrows because I said, well, that means that I can do something with it. And then the entire system looks more like this extremely complex, it looks like a bird's nest, which tells me that, again, the statistical techniques ought to be exactly what they need. But he says that the theory of strain hardening is still at the stage of being merely interpretive, not predictive, and it may never develop into such a theory. This is as recently as 2002. Here's Cox and Becky, who are the great people at Los Alamos who worked out the equations of motion. An ab initio theory of strain hardening is unlikely ever to be derived even for a specific case and impossible with any generality. And here's, even more recently, Ladislav Kuban is the great person who leads all the dislocation dynamic stuff, and his picture was on the front of my presentation, and he says the present dislocation models for strain hardening still have difficulties in integrating an elementary dislocation problem into a continuum description of bulk crystals or polycrystals. As a consequence, current approaches cannot avoid making use of extensive parameter fitting. All right. Here's something, and this is why I didn't want Sid to miss the beginning. Sid sent me this from a meeting that he was at on materials modeling in the Bay Area. And this is coming from the Lawrence Livermore National Lab. And it's apparently a major program that they have. But I just want you to notice one little, this is the equations that he's going to use to fit a whole lot of that. I want you to notice one piece of this, where he says that the density of dislocations, that's this rho dot, which is a scalar, is proportional to a strain rate. A strain rate is a tensor. He doesn't tell you what would happen if you strained it in the other direction. And I've had people, when I've complained about that, say, oh, you just put the absolute value there. I say, well, you never find absolute values in that kind of a place in a real theoretical physics calculation. But oh, no, they don't bother with that. And then they also they figure out what the saturation density is. They use a power law, which they invent. All right. Let me go to the Los Alamos dot. Here is a set of data for the stress on a logarithmic scale as a function of the strain rate coming from the famous paper by Preston, Tonks, and Wallace from Los Alamos. And there are a number of things that are important to see here. One is that there's a whole lot of data that appear down in here, and then there's a region at really high strain rates. This is 10 to the 10th, 10 to the 11th, 10 to the 12th per second, and they're doing that by by shock waves and deducing the data, this interpretation of the data by looking at the interpretation of shock waves. At Los Alamos, you don't, and I don't really want to know why they're interested in shock waves and impacts at materials at high at high strength, but they are interested in it, and it probably makes some difference to us whether they get it right. Okay, but there are a couple of features of this. They also base their analysis on exactly the same kinds of equations that I showed you that Sid sent me last week. But you notice that what's going on here at the low, relatively low, it's only about 8 or 9 decades of strain rate. At 8 or 9 decades of strain rate, and it goes up by maybe a factor of 2. So that's almost constant. What?
2 orders.
No, this is 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2. Okay, that's a log scale. It's almost constant, very, very slow. And then all of a sudden it jumps up to something that you would think was sort of measurable as a sort of a hardening. So there's this dramatic shift of the behavior. Here's the temperature dependence, and I'm just combining a whole lot of data that they sent me. It's hotter, required stress gets smaller, and colder, it gets bigger. That's sort of what you'd expect. Here's up.
And these, I assume, are sort of the theorist's guide to the eye, and what does the eye actually look like?
Well, here, these are real data.
Correct.
And I'll give it the data.
Should I really take this seriously, Scott, or is this just, there's a lot of scatter and some little lines?
Here it's a little bit more complicated. It's roughly that, though. I think the statement is quite accurate, that it's a very slow increase in the stress. And here's what you do. Remember, the last one I was showing you was stress versus strain, right? Here's stress versus strain. And so here are three different curves of the, and these are their actual data. These are at very different strain rates, 0.066, 960, almost 2,000 per second. These are roughly the same, relatively high temperature, all about the same temperature, roughly speaking. What you want to do to get yourself into the framework that's relevant is understand that this is the elastic region, way down there. In fact, I've probably exaggerated its size, but you get the sense of it. Here, these curves will bend over, and they get to something like steady state deformation. You get a constant. These values of the stress are what you would call the flow stress for steady state behavior. And then the really interesting thing, you saw those quotations that I was showing, I'll talk about strain hardening. And that's this question of how this bends over and what causes that sort of behavior to occur. What's happening? And let me give you the bottom line. The bottom line, and this everybody agrees to, is basically that as you get this thing going, you create more and more dislocations. The dislocations bump into each other in Mr. Cuttrell's bird's nest, and that makes it harder to move it. So that the working this material hardens it in a rather natural way. That's the physics of what we're trying to describe. And that's not hard. All right. Now, how can thermodynamics be relevant to this? And I want to spend a little bit of time discussing this question. Let's consider only systems that are undergoing persistent deformation. In other words, for the moment, we'll talk about increasing the strain, but basically slowly. They're undergoing persistent deformation in response to external driving forces. I'm driving them out of equilibrium. The dislocations are moving chaotically. That's a good assumption. You look at what's going on in micrographs. It looks as if they're doing that. Even they seem to be behaving chaotically in numerical computer simulations. So we can assume that they're exploring statistically significant fractions of their configuration spaces. Okay. That's a sort of a Gibbsian requirement for doing statistics. Accordingly, a macroscopically large system of dislocations, which might be a square micron or something, but maybe a bit bigger, must be near its state of maximum probability. That means maximum entropy, or it must be moving toward that state. Lisa?
This is a technical question. You say dislocations, you're meaning dislocation lines, not individual dislocations?
Well, dislocation lines, yes.
Because presumably dislocations actually are strongly correlated along the line. And so what you're saying is
the term that's used is dislocations or dislocation line interchangeably.
Great. I just wanted to make sure a
dislocation you think of as a defect in a material, but unlike our STZs or what have you, these are lines that go for basically macroscopic distances. They'll go from one side of a grain to another. Sometimes they'll be loops. In fact, as you saw in the original picture, they form dislocation loops. I didn't say anything about it being isotropic. Okay. I said. Well, I don't know what you look for the direction. You'll see how it moves in a minute. Yeah, Marcus.
It's statement is generically valid, and the problem is finding the probability measure, no?
Yeah. But my point here is simply that a system like this must obey some form of the second law of thermodynamics. In other words, entropy must be non-decreasing. That's why is my pointer not working? Now, in principle, and in fact even in practice, I can measure the energies of dislocation. And we know that those energies are vastly greater than kT, by several orders of magnitude. So that means that if you just let a metal or crystal sit, there aren't going to be very many dislocations that are going to be either formed spontaneously or annihilated spontaneously. The temperature fluctuations are not big enough to do anything like that. But the energy, which I call U sub C, of a configuration of dislocations, is a well-defined number. It's basically an energy per unit of length. The number of such configurations at a given energy is also, in principle, a well-defined quantity, which we can even sort of estimate. Thus, the configurational entropy is also well defined. Therefore, I can take a derivative and I get a quantity that is a temperature. It's an effective temperature. It's obviously not the same as the ambient temperature, but in fact, it's going to be very big because it has this energy scale in it, and the entropy itself is as Cottrell complained, is too small to be important. Therefore, this is a real temperature. And according to Gibbs, what we ought to do is form the free energy, UC minus this chi times the entropy, and look for a minimum of that free energy, and that would be the most probable state of the system. Okay. And how can this be comparable to that? Because although S is small, chi can be very big. Now the question is, are you allowed to do that for non-equilibrium systems when the thing is moving? I don't have time to give the lecture that on the various papers that Bookbinder and I have written on that subject. Here the answer is, yeah, it's okay. I beg you just to take my word for it that this is all right here. So sometimes that it's not. I see all sorts of grumps here. Now, start by thinking about steady state deformation. Rho is technically the length of dislocations per unit volume. I'm going to measure chi in units of some characteristic energy per dislocation, which is a very big energy, I want to do a dimensionless kind of analysis. And then, if you really want to worry about it, see the Bookbinder-Langer paper that I mentioned previously. What you expect now is that the density of dislocations is going to have this familiar Boltzmann-like factor, where A is just some sort of a characteristic atomic spacing in the system. All right? How do we use that result? Now, that obviously is quite different from the assumptions that have been made in this field before, but using, sort of funny phenomenological equations, it's a working assumption that I think works pretty well. And in fact, this I've been able to check pretty well by looking at the experimental data of numbers of dislocations. So what do I need to use this? And now there's sort of two parts of the next part of this talk. I need to have an expression of the plastic strain rate, which I call epsilon dot in this talk, as a function of the stress and the dislocation density. In other words, I want a physics-based constitutive law for the system. And the other thing I need is a relation between the strain rate and the effective temperature in order to complete this description and be able to solve then for the stress as a function of the strain rate. So what I'm going to, let's put this off until I get into it, because this is where I'm really making a connection to the stuff that we've been talking about in other connections. Yes, Matt, Marcus.
Actually, you're just assuming that the energy stored in the dislocation is conserved. Is that
almost, but not quite. Yeah. In other words, if I have an amount of dislocation line, I certainly don't change that by thermal fluctuation. Either up or down. But I'm going to look at one of the important equations of motion that I'll write down, but only later. The thing that actually replaces that expression for the time rate of change of the density of dislocations is, in fact, an energy-related equation. It's an expression of the first law of thermodynamics that tells me how the energy stored in the dislocations depends on the amount of work I'm doing on the system.
Why do these dislocations go up to photons?
Well, they do, and that's a big issue in the field, is that lots of people think that the coupling to photons, especially as a dislocation moves from one place to another, is an appreciable damping mechanism. And I've tried to put it into this theory, and I was rather amazed to discover that it doesn't. It's not needed. That does happen, but it's a much smaller effect. That's not the usual assumption. In fact, if you looked at that first page of equations that Sid sent me, you would see a great big thing that says phonon drag. And that's what they use to add to their theory in order to get from their result to the experimental result. Well, we can get back to that. Other questions about what I'm...
Just in terms of calculating the energy, the work you have to do to move a dislocation, that's important.
I'm going to argue, and that's what's going to happen in the next couple slides, that the main thing where we have to do work, and in fact where we have to count on actually real thermal fluctuations, is in depinning the dislocations. That's the main source, the place where energy comes in and where energy is stored and energy is to go out. Here's the picture. And again, it's an oversimplified picture. This is why these guys say, oh, you don't have to worry about Langer. He doesn't know the difference between an edge dislocation and a screw dislocation, which I do, as a matter of fact. but I don't go much further than that. Okay? And what you want to think about, here are the dislocations that we're talking about, and they're sort of extra planes that come perpendicular to the valves. And they're going to have to jump from one place to another, and they move through what's often called a forest of other dislocations that are oriented in, for simplicity, we just make it a perpendicular direction. And so what's the mechanism that is important is that here is a place where this dislocation is pinned on that. It's going to have to become depinned and move over to the next pinning site. And I maintain that the time taken for that to happen is essentially all of the time that you need to organize. You don't have to, as I say, it's a bit of a a surprise even for me that the time taken for this to go from there to there turns out to be negligible. But let's go through this a bit. There's, you know, one of the people who I don't think ever made a mistake in all of these things was Taylor, G.I. Taylor. And he immediately identified a typical stress, you know, on a dislocation. And here's the Taylor stress. He says, well, there's a shear modulus, but now suppose it, this thing moves a direction, a distance, b prime. B is the what's called the Burgers vector, which is basically an atomic spacing in this case. So B prime divided by L is like a shear strain. And you want to multiply that by a modulus, and you get a stress. Now, L is like the square root of the density of dislocations. Remember, it's a sort of an aerial density of lines, so that dimensionally, it has to be the square root. And it was Taylor who understood that a typical characteristic stress in these systems, basically on dimensional grounds, had to be this thing that looks like a modulus times the square root of the density. That's the Taylor stress. Now, that's a beautiful thing. And let's see what it is. I've already said this to people. What you want to do is you want to think about these dislocations being pinned in this forest of other dislocations and hopping from one place to another. And now you want to figure out, well, how rapidly does that hopping take place as a function of the shear stress? All right, now here's some equations. I'm going to say that the depinning is a real thermally activated thing. We know that these things are temperature dependent. I've shown in the original data lots of temperature dependent. So it's got to be some activation factor with an energy, and that depinning energy has got to be dependent upon the applied stress. In other words, I pull the thing off, I lower the barrier to depin. And there's a sort of an attempt frequency, which roughly, you know, a vibrational frequency or something, maybe a bit longer, but about 10 to the minus 12 seconds works. Now, how do I write this thing down? I want it to work for fairly large stresses. And often when you write, you know, activation formulas like this, you just linearize there. But if I linearized, I would get something that would go through zero at some finite stress, and I don't want to do that. But the one function that I can invent that has only one parameter in there, one characteristic stress, and doesn't go through zero, is just an exponential. I'm doing dimensional analysis. And the question, basically my point is that it isn't going to make too much difference if I make this more complicated, and I'll just sort of lose contact with the numbers. So I'm going to put in this exponentially decaying, and the characteristic stress on which it decays exponentially is going to be this Taylor stress. And I'm going to, you know, if in fact the stress is small, then it looks as if it's the standard linear thing. If it's big, it will at least saturate in some sensible way. David, you want to
know the signal from signal out?
You can try that.
I just don't understand the signal as possible.
I like this one. you can do that. I think you get the same results, essentially. Although, this one, it makes it a little bit easier to get some analytic approximations from. So that means if I assume that the dislocation spends almost all of its time in a pin state and only occasionally jumps instantaneously from one state to another, if you look at the paper that I mentioned to you, I went through a whole bunch of minima analysis pointing out that the time that it takes isn't going to be important, except in not the regime that's interesting here. Then what I say is that the strain rate, which I'm putting in dimensionless terms and putting that tau naught in, is going to be, well, I have to, this is a relationship due to Orlov. It's basically geometry or dimensional analysis. But it's 1 over the time. If I have a positive stress and I have to symmetrize it, in principle, but in fact, for most of the situations that I'm interested in, this term is negligible. So I have a formula for the strain rate. But of course, it depends not just on the stress, but it depends on the density dislocations at this stage. Now, if I put, here's one of the reasons I like using the exponential form, is that now I can just solve, and I get an expression for the stress in units of the Taylor stress. And here's the logarithm of the temperature. This was the depinning activation temperature, or the temperature that comes into the activation formula. And minus, there's a double log here of the density of dislocations and the strain rate. So you immediately can see that this is a very slowly varying function of the strain rate. Yeah, but if I put your version in, it would be the same thing.
Because it would. Power.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, come on. Okay, it has. But it would be a different function. Okay. It's easiest to see here that it works out like that. You look, David. I'll let you work on this with me, and you work it out for a different formula and see if it fits the data. All right. Get me the answer by tomorrow. Okay, so the point is that as long as the strain rate is entirely this plastic, then the stress is proportional to this Taylor stress, and the proportionality factor is a very slowly varying function of its arguments. So this is the physics-based constitutive relation. Now I come to what's much more interesting to this audience, namely, well, how do I get a relationship between the effective temperature and the rate at which I'm shearing the system? And this is an idea that was obviously, you'll see it was in my head for obvious reasons. Because what I want you to think about is that if I take a bubble wrap, again, it's one of Andrew's group's numerical experiments, and I shear it. And they measure the temperature of this thing. It does, the bubbles are you know, much too big to have any real temperature dependence, but they then have various standard techniques to measure the temperature dependence of this thing as a function of its shear rate. And here's a set of graphs that I took from this paper by Ono O'Hearn and et al. And it's they're measuring the temperature. They call it T, because it's a limit of temperature, and I call it chi. But the units of chi are not the same as the units are strange. Don't worry about them. And here's for a bidisperse, sort of a colloidal or bubble graph, and here's polydispersed. And you see what happens here is that at small strain rates, it goes to something that looks like a constant. And I want to emphasize the sort of plausibility of that, is that what you might think, what you're doing when you shear this thing is essentially you're stirring it. And I think it's very plausible that as a function of stirring rate, that you control the disorder. And in fact, if you stir it more slowly than any internal relaxation rate in the system, as long as you stir for long enough, you should get to the same effective disorder temperature as you would get at any other strain rate in that regime. And therefore, you get these flat regions here, and chi goes to some constant value, the system-dependent value, granted, but a constant value. What?
What is the definition?
What is the
definition?
What is the? They did actually a whole bunch of different ways and to see that they're consistent. Basically, using fluctuation dissipation theories, they look at the kinetic energy fluctuations and
different ways.
They were really pretty consistent. They were really pretty careful.
Unfortunately, the one that you really want to see, which is DUDS.
Oh, do you look?
Do.
Well, that's harder, yeah. They try to actually measure the entropy and see whether they can get a direct evaluation of my formula, and it didn't work very well. But I think it was numerical problems. It wasn't. Who knows? Yeah. In any case. But now, the other interesting thing is that there seems to be a divergence there. So that this thing rises at some place where the strain rate begins to compete with some internal time scales in the system, and this thing starts taking off. Right now, I like this idea. Let's just turn this graph on its side. It's one of those graphs. I just rotated that slide by 90 degrees. And now what I want you to notice is that this looks very much like a graph of viscosity versus temperature, which is look like a graph of alpha relaxation time versus temperature. Yesterday I was fussing about it not being not quite that, but for these purposes it's all right. And so here's something sort of like it's diverging in a glass transition. And then it's coming down here, and this looks like it's the Arrhenius part of the temperature dependence of the viscosity. And notice what this is. This is coming to be now exactly what we want, because this is the inverse of the strain rate, and this is the temperature. So the point is that we're trying to see whether there might be some more or less universal, at least semi-quantitative, relationship between temperature and the rate at which I'm stirring. This is the kind of thing that Sid has been looking for. Sid and I are all excited. We're going to, as I said yesterday, we're going to be quixotic about this. What does that mean? It means that what we're saying is that this effective temperature is a function. Remember, Q is the strain rate dimension. It's going to go to some constant for very small values of Q. And it's going to go, well, what I'm really saying is that it looks like it's an Arrhenius plot at the large values of Q. So I'm going to use that kind of relationship. As if A is in these dimensionless units some sort of an activation barrier, which might in fact be twice the energy of pulling apart two dislocations, but we'll see. And so that's the relationship that I want here. So then if I have this one, then I put the two things together and I'm getting an expression for the density as a function of strain rate. And then I put that back in the stress as a function of density, and I, with well, that's just the Taylor stress expression. So I put there was this thing that I showed you before, and now I have a formula for the rho as a function of Q. This gives me the stress as a function of the strength. And that's actually fairly simple. And this is the result. Here it is for one of the temperatures for copper. I just put a couple of the data points that I was able to, that I extracted from the literature. If you'd like, I could have put more of them in there. But it gives me a curve that comes through these data points. And it goes out there, and I have to do some fiddle there in order to, and that I think I can show is a heating effect, that when you go that far, you actually raise the ambient temperature by a bit, and going to that highest strain rate. But the point is that this rapid growth of chi, the effective temperature, as I get to strain rates that are comparable to some internal rate in the system, it shows up there. Yeah, Lisa.
Is the internal rate that you have to put in to make this match like the Debye temperature? The Debye frequency?
I don't think that's a...
I mean, I'm wondering, you say once you reach an internal, I'm just wondering, like, what is that internal time scale?
Well, look.
It has to be to fit the data.
The next slide but one has the parameters that I need to fit in order to get this agreement with the data. Okay, and it's,
I don't know much about copper, so.
Well, okay.
So you have to put that in context for me.
Well,
so.
No. Let me look. I think you'll see where the numbers are coming. Marcus, yeah.
There's something I don't understand at all. So usually the effective temperature is the bigger the objects are. So in this case, they are much bigger than the phonons, therefore they have a higher effective temperature. No,
I don't understand that at all.
I mean, this is also what happens in mean field classes and so on. But I thought that was the same in your thing, but now you say that the effective temperature goes the size of your objects goes down?
No, the effective temperature goes up as the rate at which I'm shearing. The rate it goes up as the rate at which it means this goes up as the rate at which I'm adding energy to the system. Here's where we're getting into the question that was it you or somebody else who asked, you know, are we looking at constant energy, making a constant energy assumption? And of course, that's exactly wrong. This is a driving rate along the horizontal axis.
And the Q is what?
The Q is just the strain rate it multiplied by some characteristic time scale, which is basically the phonon, the molecular oscillation period, the microscopic time scale. I'll show you exactly, in fact, it's 10 to the minus 12 seconds times the actual strain. Okay. But here's the point, is that there is a temperature dependence. Here's what we get for these different temperatures. You know, I showed you before the 1100, 300, 100K measurements. I don't have too much good data for the 100. I do have some. There are points here. There's another point that I measured. I just stuck in down there. And so the temperature dependence works out okay, too. And this is, you see, this is room temperature. This is some fraction of the melting temperature of copper. That's about a third. And that's below room temperature. So, but now here's your question. somebody's question is what, you know, where does that temperature come in? And Lisa was also wanting to know. And let's look at the next slide.
Back to the question of putting in the exponential dependence.
Yeah.
How much would this shift around if you had a weaker functional?
Well, that's part of this too. Okay. Again, look. Here are the numbers, and these are all of the numbers that need to be fit or chosen in order to make those graphs. And one of them, as I said, is the tau naught, which gives me the scale of the strain, right? I got the chi naught, which is the saturation value of the effective temperature, by looking at other graphs of density dislocations as a function of strain rate, but temperature. I'm sorry, this is 4 years, 5 years ago, and I'm trying to remember what I got that from. But I remember looking at graphs and fitting the density of dislocations that are observed by X-ray techniques. Here's the pinning energy. Remember the TP came in that expression. And then it would give me a pinning energy, and then I reduced it with this stress-dependent function. And so that turns out to be, in order to fit this data, it requires about 3 electron volts, which seems to be perfectly reasonable. Here's the number that comes in defining the Taylor stress, and it says that you have to go about 1/30th of the distance between, or the spacing between, of the Berger's vector in order to get it out of the pinning region. And then here's that number that's the exponent that I fit. That's the effective temperature versus strain rate number. This is the Arrhenius number, you need to the minus A over chi, it's 2 over chi. And remember the chi is in units of some large energy of dislocation lines. And that works remarkably well. Why 2, I don't know. But in fact, if I vary that very much, I don't get this smooth connection between the the smooth connection between the slow part and the upturn. But that gives me both this connection properly, becomes irrelevant down here, and it gives me the upturn like that. So it looks as if that piece of the physics holds together. Now, I'm not doing the parameter fitting kind of analysis that the pessimists were saying. Now, I have to do more parameter fitting in order to do actual strain hardening theory. If I want to do stress versus strain rather than stress versus strain rate. And here's the analog of that equation that I complained to you so badly about, is that I want to say that the effective temperature, or this is probably the closer analog, but here's the density of dislocations. And yes, it's going to be proportional to the strain rate, but I multiply it by the stress so that I get a scalar, and that's the power into the system. That is legal for physics students, okay? Now what I'm doing is both of these equations, this one, I'm simply saying that, okay, rho is going to reach this equilibrium value that we've computed before. So I'm going to say that, yes, there's some relaxation towards equilibrium, and the relaxation rate is going to be determined by this power in play. there are a couple of constants there that I have to, new numbers that I have to fit in order to get agreement. This is basically the first law. This is basically the equilibration of the and while using energy conservation instead of magic to get that. I've already said that the time scale is set by the rate at which I'm putting power into the system. And now I can get actually rather better fits up to the data. The black curves are my curves, but I have to be careful. And notice here that I'm going, this is all the sort of high temperatures, but very different strain rates. And the next graph is at relatively low temperatures, but very different strain rates. In order to get these curves, I don't have to fiddle with any, make any extra numbers like the proportionality factors that have some funny strain rate dependence or temperature dependence. But I do have to be careful, and one of the many parts of this thing is not worked out. I do have to be careful with the initial conditions. So it's basically a question of how the sample is prepared. And I have to introduce some parameters for what the initial values of especially the effect of temperature are in order to get these things to match.
Are you going
to talk at some point about how I think about a disorder temperature and an disorder solid? Well, but look, here I'm applying it only to the dislocations. Okay. So, but the analog of the dislocations is the defects in an amorphous solid, disorder solid.
But if I want to think about it, I just want to press you for a second, but if I want to think about it, this as being the derivative of the, energy with respect to an entropy, what you're saying is I want to be considering the entropy of the dislocations only, which are some gas, or not gas, obviously, to say it right, but like some I'm interested in the set of states of the dislocations, and those are allowed to be interesting.
Well, I have to be careful about that. Look, but to take the analog of the amorphous solid.
Well, I don't want to do, because I understand what it is.
Well, but this is much cleaner than that, is the point. This is very clean, because it's absolutely clean how I'm, what I'm looking at when I'm looking just at the dislocations, the pictures of them. I can see pictures of them and observe directly with these fancy electron micrographs. And so they're essentially an isolated system that is only weakly interacting with the rest of the system. It's not interacting. Obviously, I have this thermal activation of the depinning that's going on, and that shows up in the experimental data with the temperature dependence, and it shows up in the theory. But that's the analog of our weak interaction between the configurational degrees of freedom in an amorphous solid and the vibrational degrees of freedom. So, but here it's cleaner than that. There's no question which degrees of freedom are part of the analog of the configurational degrees of freedom. And the dislocations are there. We can see them. We know they're weakly coupled to the rest of the system. We know we can't create or annihilate them simply by the thermal fluctuations. It's a much more obvious case, in my opinion. That's why I sort of liked this. Because it was cleaner than what you and I have been struggling with for some years. I think I'm going to even finish on time. Is that allowed, Karen? That means you guys didn't ask enough hostile questions, or I didn't go into enough detail.
This will.
What?
There's still time.
There's still time. This is a slide that it dates from when I was giving this talk to, I gave it Los Alamos once. I gave it a couple of materials engineering departments. So I called these heresies. The first heresy is that non-equilibrium thermodynamics is relevant to dislocation-mediated plasticity. That's given the back of my hand and say, look, you can't possibly have anything of that sort to this. This isn't that kind of system. Well, the hell it is. Now, here's something I didn't even bring up. One of the things that, especially the Los Alamos group, going back to Cox, talked about were two different kinds of dislocations, stored and mobile dislocations. Those of you who may be familiar with the field know that people talk a lot about that. The dislocations that were moving were different, colored differently than the ones that were stuck in. I don't see any reason for doing that. Now, the Cox-Mecking equation, that's the one for the dislocation density that relates the time derivative of dislocation density to the strain rate, and violates fundamental physical principles, and it's replaced by a simple statement of energy conservation. There's another question that came up here. I don't want to stop on time.
Yeah, in terms of the second point, do people really talk about permanently stored versus...
I don't understand. Come on, don't ask me to explain it. I don't think it was said.
They use the term like geometrically necessary.
Well, that's another thing. That's not stupid. But it's a subtle use of different time scales. I can go into that a bit, it may actually turn out to be relevant here, because it's a question of how rapidly the plastic deformation occurs and how rapidly the reorientation of the crystal occurs. The other thing that I've mentioned from the beginning is that there is the speed at which a dislocation moves from one pinning site to another. Big emphasis on that, undoubtedly, in order to explain the data, especially this upshoot. And they say that, well, if you're going faster, then you get more resistance for and therefore you take more time going from one pinning site to another. And I wish, when I did these equations 5 years ago, solving them, I was sure that had to be right, and I put in that time constant, and every time I tried to fit the data, worked harder and tried to narrow it down, it came out to be zero. But that's still, as you saw from the one slide at the beginning, part of the dogma in the field. I'm rather pessimistic about this field because I don't think that even with SIDS help I can tilt at those windows. But let me point out some probably solvable problems. One thing I didn't put in here that's absolutely necessary is that there's elastic energy in the system. I simply said, implicitly said, that the energy is simply the energy per dislocation times the number of dislocations. But these dislocations interact with each other via elastic interactions, and you ought to put that in. And I have some notes that I've written down. I think it's not too hard to put it in as it gets a little bit messy. Let me just jump to this, because I think that the fact that when you see, and you look in more structure at some of these curves, in more detail, that you see sort of up jumps and things of that sort that seem to be related to the formation of the dislocations, like the form clumps, and they make cells, and those cells actually, I think, are involved in later reorganizing of the grain structure. That's completely missing here, and it must have to do with the fact that that there are energetic reasons, elastic energetic reasons, why the dislocations would like to be close to each other. And I've left that out altogether. The onset of hardening is something else that's not dealt with properly here. As I said, in order to get the onset of those curves to fit right, I had to make some assumptions about what the initial conditions were, which were sort of like the question of how the system was prepared, but I think it may go a bit deeper than that. In fact, I'm pretty sure it does. And then getting on to this question of cellular dislocation patterns immediately leads to the question of, well, these systems form shear mass. How do we get that? They also have a dynamic recrystallization. What happens is that there's a big changes in the grain structure as you go faster and faster. And it could be that these things also provide softening mechanisms at the high strain rates. That may be something to do with the extra structure of those curves that they saw, but I don't know. I got doing this, I got, to be perfectly honest, quite frustrated that nobody wanted to pay any attention. I knew I couldn't get any grant support for working in this area, and I've not succeeded yet in getting other people to help out on it. And Sid is going to recruit an army, right? Mm-hmm. And we're going to Sid and I are going to, we promise each other we're going to go tilt at those windmills. So thank you very much for this. More questions? Yeah, let's see, Bob and then Lisa.
So early on you said that the effective temperature, you invoked a free energy,
minimization
principle, which requires that you, and the additional unstated thing is that you, it applies a constant time. And F replaces U or S minimum, maximum, when T is up there. Can you comment on that here? I mean, how do I understand? So I have an effective temperature which is vague, and that this is a perfectly fine thing to invoke a free energy minimum principle, and so how well can you really pin that down?
Okay, well that, there's, at the very beginning of the talk, I mentioned, well, there was a paper that Aaron and I, actually it said three papers that Aaron and I wrote about what's the proper formulation of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics for situations like this. And the key idea there was to identify what the relevant internal degrees of freedom are that may fall out of equilibrium with the ambient temperature.
Yeah, but I'm not doing ambient temperature. I'm going to grant you that
that's
fine. You're going to do the non-equilibrium.
Okay. So look, obviously, the density of dislocation lines is a relevant internal variable. It's in fact going to be out of equilibrium with the ambient temperature by a lot in this case. In amorphous plasticity, it's not so huge amount, and in fact, when you drive the system harder, it liquefies, and the two temperatures, we have an equation that shows me how the two temperatures equilibrate. Okay, but I'm not answering your question.
No.
Okay. The next step that you have to do is you have to take your particular equations of motion for those internal variables, and then write down an equation using those equations of motion for the time rate of change of the entropy.
Yeah.
And then you have to insist that that time rate of change of the entropy always, and always is an important point there, be non-negative. And that gives you a whole lot of interesting things. It gives you essentially the Boltzmann factor that I showed you there. It can give you the Boltzmann factor with perhaps a slightly different prefactor, but and it's not, that's not very interesting. It can, however, give you interesting constraints in the SDZ theory. It gives you a very interesting constraint on the SDZ, the SDZ transition rates. It's easy to understand when you see it, but it doesn't come out of minimizing a free energy. It does not come out of any analysis of the second law that starts from stating that there has to be the motion has to be the gradient of an entropy or a free energy. It turns out that you can have quite interestingly different kinds of things coming out, starting from this fundamental principle that you have to have well-defined internal state variables, and you have to be careful about how you do that. That's not always done right. And those equations of motion for those internal state variables must be consistent with the second law. Okay? It seems to me to be a pretty general point of view for these problems. And in this case, is about as clean as it gets, because the dislocations are so clearly a subsystem described by a well-defined internal state variable all by themselves. Now, did I answer? Well.
You answered a different question that was interesting.
Do you want to try again?
No, that's okay.
Yes?
I was curious, besides the sort of fit that you did, is there evidence that the effective temperature for the configurational degrees of dislocations has a behavior with strain rate that's similar to the one that you extracted from disordered systems? And if there isn't any direct evidence for that, is there something somebody could do to actually check?
Well,
right, because you stated basically how the effective temperature that governs dislocations changes with strain rate. That's an ingredient in your theory.
Yeah.
And then you showed us pictures of how the effective temperature for configurational degrees of freedom in disordered systems changes with strain rate.
Yeah.
As evidence for that. And I was just wondering, is there a way to sort of test that conjecture directly in a simulation with dislocations?
You could try, but it looks to me as if what I did here is a direct test of that. If that were not right, this whole business would have fallen apart. But
I'm just saying I would actually feel much more comfortable with everything if I could see a plot of that object that came from real data.
It came from real data.
It seems to me that maybe you could actually think of a way to do it, given that, dislocations are sort of so out of equilibrium, maybe I should be able to do that.
People do measure the dislocation density as a function of strain rate. And in fact, that's a good next step for somebody. There are such graphs.
Yeah, I let them talk to these offline now.
Yeah.
You can actually look at experimental data and see what Jim is saying, but I understand what you're saying. You want to move away from crystalline system to disorder system?
No. She wants to stay with the crystalline system.
I just want you to take the dislocation density from real data use convert it via this equation that you gave me. Convert that to an effective temperature using the equation, and show me that it has exactly the functional form. Jim postulated with the strain.
Okay, I think that that's not been done as carefully and directly as what Lisa is saying.
That's right.
Very useful.
It's been done a lot by lots of
in code, but no one has done it the way Jim has done it.
Sure. Right. So somebody should just do that, yes. And then this would maybe would gain a lot more
we
attention.
Can show you what people have been doing. In fact, last week, there was this whole session on facilitation plasticity and shock experiments. So and I can tell you, once you get into that area, lots of new questions coming up about face transitions and the shock question of these face transitions in iron and alpha and gamma. There's a lot of details there, but for sure, we have lots of experimental data. The one that you said you asked me for, I can show you.
I might be able to find something. Yeah.
Does the effective temperature coincide with the real one in the linear regime?
No. But I'm not sure what you mean by the linear regime.
Linear
elasticity.
Yes.
Yeah, but that's when I'm not generating new dislocations. And then, in fact, the effective temperature, if the real temperature is extraordinarily small compared to the energy of a dislocation line. So, but that's interesting. It's a regime that people have played with a very pure, small crystals. And they look at just a few dislocations, and they see, in fact, that they can get chaotic behavior. What's the name of the man who's, come on, it's a sign of age, the names that I know quite. And there's a lot of, and this theory does not pertain to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought it could be taken as a test of consistency.
Well, it's obviously consistent because it says that if you're at very small strain rates and ordinary temperatures, so that you have only a small number of dislocations that might be there accidentally. Then e to the minus a over chi is essentially zero, that's all you get.
Yeah, but on the other hand, chi has a low amount.
Be careful, Charles. Chi in that regime, chi communicates with the ordinary temperature, as you very well know. Okay? And therefore, it can be much smaller than chi naught, because chi naught is what you get when you've been shearing it for a long time, very slowly.
Right.
Okay? And that's definitely not the ambient temperature.
Right.
The ambient temperature can be very much lower than that.
Right.
It really doesn't make too much sense to talk about chi in that regime, but if you just let it sit for a long time, the disorder temperature will equilibrate with the ambient temperature.
Right.
Just the way it does in all of the granular things.
I was thinking of the equilibrium state regime.
Well, if you do that and you do it for long enough. But here you see, in order to get chi up to chi naught, you might have to be straining that slowly for the age of the universe. Because you're really orders of magnitude difference. That's what's so clean about this, in essence, is that the dislocation system is just off scale from the ordinary thermal fluctuations.
Yeah. With this theoretical concept, can you rationalize the intermittency? We see when we shear small, when we deform small plastic samples or metallic alloy samples, or the scale-free statistic of these avalanches. There is a way to reconcile this theory with these observations.
That's another good research project. The thing that I'm not playing with here is the detailed dynamics of dislocations when there are small numbers of them, other than this bird's nest thing. Then, in fact, people see chaotic behavior. And then I say that's exactly what I would expect because I have basically a deterministic system. Fluctuations are not going to be terribly important. And so that the things are going to, maybe they interact with each other, they get trapped, pinned on each other, and then they're released, and you see that as an avalanche in that vision. I think that's perfectly legitimate, but it's another example. Here I think it's easier to understand of how we need to be clear about the difference between these avalanches that are in the title of this program and when we get ordinary thermodynamic shear banding, which is another kind of instability.
Yeah, but they're observing the same system. You cannot separate, say, I do a survey from one, and I do another survey for the other phenomenon. They seem to be part of the same.
No, be careful.
Of the same system.
I'm not saying that they're the same system under the same conditions. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that, let's talk about the granular systems or the glassy system. And there's no doubt I can go to low enough temperatures and small amount of strain rates, and I can generate avalanches that will occur with some sort of statistical thing that Karen tells us all about. My only objection there is that I don't think you can get the statistics in a sensible way if you do it AQS simulations, because I think you still need to pay attention to the internal dynamics in the system. But there's no question in my mind that that's a perfectly legitimate limit, and that it's a perfectly legitimate set of research problem to deal with. And then as you go to the finite temperatures or larger strain rates at low temperatures, you begin to get a system that is noisy, where whatever the defects are, the flow defects, are naturally, spontaneously being created by the noise of the system. And then the avalanches are eventually going to go away. There has to be a crossover between those regimes. And that's what I'm finding very fascinating, listening to various other talks in this program. We're talking about
two different regimes.
They do the same physical system. I might think there's a very good question.
So generally, we propose we let anybody who wants to climb on to a little while longer do so. And thank you for your good talk.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad I didn't finish too soon.